Welcome to TalkErie.com's Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast. Every day, we tackle the biggest issues that the Erie, PA region faces. Stay informed and involved as we advance the narrative of Erie. Now, here's Joel Natale.
We're excited to introduce a couple of speakers that are going to be essential to as a part of the Global Summit 13. Sponsored by the Jefferson Educational Society here. The Global Summit is back in person and with us via Zoom and also on Facebook Live right now is Anita McBride. And Anita, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Joel. I'm excited to talk to you about the summit.
All right, we're a family show. We like to get origin stories. Kind of tell us about where you grew up and kind of what got you involved in basically being an advisor to presidents and first ladies, you know?
Well, thank you a little bit, for the opportunity to share my personal story. I mean, choosing a life in politics was not something that I thought about growing up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where I'm from. My family are immigrants from Italy. My father from Calabria, my mother from outside of Naples. They met as adults in Connecticut and married and started a family. And no one in my, family was ever involved really in politics, other than of course becoming American citizens and using their opportunity to vote, of which they were quite proud. But the turnaround for me or the interest really happened when I was a junior in college and I did a junior year abroad from the University of Connecticut, my home university. It was their first year of starting a program in Florence, Italy. Mm. So I thought, well, that would be interesting for me, given that my family was from Italy. And also, I was looking to decide what my major should be. I had been a pre-med major. I was not doing as well as I would have liked. And so this was a turnaround. And that year, 1979, just turned out to be a pivotal year. That's when the American hostages were taken in Iran. I was at a foreign university with a lot of international students at the University of Florence. And really the response to what had just happened to these innocent Americans was quite shocking to me. It was almost a bit of a celebration amongst the youth at that university. I of course, finished out my year in Italy. It was an extraordinary experience, but I almost feel like I appreciated being an American and my citizenship more by being overseas and seeing the challenge to it and the challenge to our country.
Do you feel like there was that was a common experience that back in the late 70s, that there was a strong anti-American sentiment for college students or that college age people?
Well, I think so. I think, looking at our own, country at that time, we had come through several traumas, right? Mm-hmm. We had come through, Vietnam, a war that most Americans did not want. And then also the trauma of Watergate. And there were a lot of questioning of our institutions, our leaders, their veracity, their integrity. So I think that's going on at home, but also going on overseas, there was a growing anti-American movement. There was actually a really heavy communist presence in Italy, the Red Brigades, especially amongst youth in Europe and in Italy was quite strong. And those are not things I really understood going over there when I did as a 19-year-old student, but I learned pretty quickly and I actually became more patriotic than less. And I came home, it was 1980 by this point, it was the height of the presidential campaign for president. Jimmy Carter was the incumbent, Ronald Reagan was running against him. And I joined the campaign as a volunteer in Hartford, Connecticut, working the phone banks. I was still at school. I had to finish my education, of course, at UConn, but I would drive to Hartford, Connecticut and volunteer. Ronald Reagan won in 1980, and I wanted to come to Washington too.
Amazing. Yeah, talk about a turn of events from planning for med school versus you know, a political deal. So what exactly, when you landed in DC, what were you starting to do? Did you start working for a lobbyist, or how did that all work?
No, great question. When I came to DC, and I came in 1981, but I still had 12 credits or a semester that I had to finish. And my university, UConn, had a partnership with American University here in Washington that has this terrific program called the Washington Semester Program. And I was able to finish out my 12 credits. I was on a foreign policy track that time, and then also do an internship at a government agency. And I was at the Department of Commerce in their Southern European Marketing Division, in the International Trade Administration, actually. So that was my start. I finished school here and I decided I wanted to stay. Yeah. And I went about looking for a job. You know, I was like every other young, you know, person that moved to Washington, excited to work in a new administration. I really didn't have the network, the credentials, or the background. So I took a job in private sector to pay my bills, working for a company no longer exists, MCI Communications Corporation, which was part of the breakup, if you remember, of all the Bell telephone companies. Sure. But it was a great way for me to, you know, be able to afford to live here. And I continued to volunteer at the Republican National Committee and other ways to keep my fingers in the political realm. And I had a lot of friends that actually were now working in the administration, and that opened up some doors for me eventually.
So how did you cross into the White House? When did you get that famous address? 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, right?
That's right. Well, it happened in 1984. I mean,
that's pretty quick.
It took that amount of time. It took 3 years, but it did go quickly. What I had done was, by the time that the reelect came up in 1984, you know, I had saved enough money to be able to quit my job at MCI and join the campaign at a national level now here in Washington as a full-time volunteer. I worked in the polling and planning office. I was just really excited to be there. And that effort paid off, and that commitment paid off, because I was offered a job in the White House a week after the re-election in November of 1984. And it was the lowliest of staff positions, but I was thrilled. I was hired as a correspondence analyst, which meant that I read the mail that came into the White House every single day. And at that time, of course, it came in big bags from the Postal Service, just hundreds of letters in every bag. And we opened them up, read them, coded them. Some had dispositions to go to different agencies to be handled. Others were put in a sample for President Reagan to read every single day, and especially a larger sample that he took to Camp David every weekend. That was it was exciting for me.
That's amazing. I want you to jump back just a second for the campaign, mm-hmm. and just share a little bit of that experience, because people think it's a very glamorous job being on the campaign trail. Not so much, right? I mean, it's really kind of grueling when you're in the middle of it, isn't it?
You know, and certainly some positions are more grueling than others, particularly the people, the advanced people that have to turn an event on a dime, and that's 24/7 work. And sometimes, you know, you can be in five, you know, different places, or the candidate can be in five different, you know, cities in a matter of 48 hours. And that's a lot of work to put those events together. You know, I didn't have it quite as hard as that, but it is a fast moving, you know, experience. Things are changing. You're following, particularly in polling and planning, you're following, you know, all of, you know, what the polls are saying in every single, you know, district and community and state. And honestly, in 1984, probably one of the last of the landslide elections. Yes. And, you know, it felt very confident and very comfortable, although you never take anything for granted. But it was, you know, it was busy, and you know, the election was an incredible result, 49 out of 50 states. In fact, one of my greatest memories of that campaign was on election night. There was the big national election party that was here in Washington at the Omni Shoreham Hotel, a historic hotel. And in the big ballroom was an enormous map, and nothing was electronic really then. And so my job was to turn every state that went for Reagan Bush. And so it was 49 states. You know, he only didn't win Minnesota, of course, Walter Mondale state, and the District of Columbia, which I'm not sure any Republican has ever won.
I wouldn't think so. Anita McBride is our guest. We're going to take a quick break here, 90 seconds. When we come back, we're going to talk about how she made her move, I guess it's called, to the East Wing, and worked with First Ladies and what she's going to bring to the table next Monday as she appears with the folks at the Jefferson Educational Society. We are talking to Anita McBride. She is going to be on the Jefferson's dais as part of Global Summit 13 for next Monday, the 8th, from 7:30 to 9, along with Barbara Perry and Stacey Corderi. And the three panelists will discuss several former First Ladies in a Global Summit program in partnership with the First Ladies Association for Research and Education and American University. The panel will be moderated by Steve Scully, again, Erie native here. All right, so what... it is the East Wing, right? Isn't it, Anita, that you go to when you are serving the First Lady? How'd you get over there?
It is the East Wing. You're absolutely right. That's the traditional domain of the First Lady's office. Well, you know, we talked, you know, earlier about being in the Reagan administration, and when I moved from correspondence to White House personnel, that I did all that job as director of White House personnel all through the Bush 41 administration. Wow. And during the 90s, when President Clinton came to Washington, that's when I took a departure from being in the White House. In fact, I'd met my husband working in the White House. He was the personal aide to George H.W. Bush as vice president and president. A lot of marriages came out of those 12 years. And I was not looking to go back into government in 2000. But if we all remember that election, was unclear for many weeks, for 6 weeks. And George W. Bush, Governor Bush, had assembled a transition team here in Washington that was operating unofficially, but you had to get started. And I had gotten a call from someone that I knew from my Bush 41 days, who was working for Governor Bush, and said, we need some help, and we need some help particularly in the administrative function, the operations, and in personnel, and can you help us? And so I did go to the transition offices that were established over in Virginia, again, unofficially by the hopeful vice president-elect, Dick Cheney, and began to work on a personnel process that would hopefully and ultimately become the operation that would move to the White House office. I said, I'll help you for as much as I have time with a babysitter. I had a 3-month-old and a 3-year-old at home. And then everything, of course, we know the election was finally decided on December 13th of 2000. George Bush and Laura Bush go into the White House in January. I was asked to help at least start up that office in the White House. I said, I'll give you 4 months until you get someone to do the job. And then it turned out to be 8 years. Wow. And in those 8 years, a lot of things, you know, happened. Of course, the transition of that first year, 9/11 in September of that year, that just really changed the entire direction course of the administration. And we'll talk a lot about that, I'm sure, next week on those panels, particularly with the chiefs of staff to the president and the President Bush himself. But I ultimately, after that first, after 9/11, so after those first nine months, I did go over to the State Department for a couple of years. Secretary Powell had asked me to come be his White House liaison, which basically handled all of the personnel appointments, the presidential appointments to the department. And that was something the White House was in complete agreement with as well. And then by 2004, George and Laura Bush, well, George Bush wins re-election. Laura Bush is first lady for a second term. And I had gotten a call that I wasn't expecting, actually, while I was driving carpool, picking up my kids on a late afternoon from Mrs. Bush's then chief of staff, Andy Ball, who had been with her since she was first lady of Texas, saying that that she was leaving to go back to Texas, Andy was, and that Mrs. Bush was looking for a new chief of staff and would like to talk to me. And I was quite surprised. I wasn't, it's not a job you really apply for. It is that type of a, you know, very close, personal, confidential role that I was honored to have the opportunity to interview with Mrs. Bush. I did that about a week later. We spent about an hour and a half talking about her vision and goals for the second term, what she wanted to accomplish. She laid things out pretty clearly, including one very dramatic statement that I wasn't expecting, was that she wanted to go to Afghanistan. I knew she had been very involved in supporting the women of Afghanistan, that she had chaired the U.S. Afghan Women's Council established by her husband. But this was a dramatically different thing. This would be the only the second first lady in our history to go to a war zone. Pat Nixon was the first when she went to Vietnam. And I went about telling Mrs. Bush how she could accomplish this visit, how she could accomplish it safely and as under the radar as possible, basically just slipping into a trip that I knew was already planned for March of 2005 for the U.S. Afghan Women's Council. And I knew that because I was working at the State Department. I knew what those plans were. And also my own husband had been on the Afghan Council because there were men and because this was a public-private partnership. So private sector working with the State Department, and there were plenty of men in corporate offices that were helping. So I, after that conversation, which was really terrific, I got a call from Andy Ball a week later with Mrs. Bush offering me the job. Wow. And that's how it happened.
I got to ask you, in our short time, we have about 3 minutes remaining. You know, when the president is in crisis, again, all eyes are on there. We got a 24/7 news cycle. We've got multiple news channels, and we've got a very strong divided, even back in the early 2000s, in the mid 2000s. I mean, it's a complicated, opinionated context. What's happening to the first lady? How much of that pain is going towards her in regards to all that attention and crisis that's going to the husband who's the president?
That's a remarkably astute question, because, you know, it's very hard. There's no one that is closer to the president of the United States than the president's spouse. And they really are invested in their success. They're also, they're focused on providing a sanctuary of family and friends around a president, in addition to doing whatever they can to support the initiatives of an administration. Again, I repeat, there's nobody more invested in the president's success than the president's spouse. Very different than any other advisor. And in fact, they are their closest confidant. And we have so many examples through our history where first ladies have done that. Look at all the recent and more accurate revelations about Nancy Reagan and her role in the Cold War. So of course they feel it deeply when the president is criticized or when things don't go well, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, these are deeply painful and difficult for the administration, but for the country and for all those families. And so, you know, again, the president's spouse will do whatever they can to alleviate any burden, make any contribution that they can to the overall goals of the administration. Oftentimes, they can shine a light on things that maybe are not being covered for the president. And then also, again, providing a family life with family and friends that come to the White House or go to Camp David or wherever it might be, so that there is some normalcy to their lives that keeps our presidents healthy, which is so important with the burdens that they carry on their shoulders every single day.
Last minute with Anita McBride, give an invitation for folks to come on out to see you and the other panelists next Monday night.
Oh, I hope that people will come or will watch live stream if they are not coming in person to the Jefferson Educational Forum. We're very excited. It's finally happened. It's been rescheduled several times. The panels every single night on the role of first ladies, the role of the presidents, of course, the chiefs of staff to the presidents, and President Bush himself, and then followed, of course, by an incredible American treasure historian, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who will put a lot of all this in perspective. But I'm particularly pleased, given the work I do at American University, directing a First Ladies Initiative, to be invited by Steve Scully and all the folks at the Jefferson Educational Forum to help put the First Lady panel together, to bring new researchers from the First Lady Association for Research and Education and my home base of American University, and the White House Historical Association, which I'm on the board, and they will be doing a teacher training program earlier the afternoon on Monday, a special program for teachers, which I think is the great challenge of our time, is civic education for our kids.
And we'll leave it there. That's amazing that that's happening. Anita McBride, thank you so much, and we're looking forward to seeing you next Monday here in Erie. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Joel.
Also working here in Erie to talk about Erie's inclusion, and we're so glad to have you on Zoom. Thank you so much, Dr. Bucette, for coming on.
It's great to be here, Joel, and it's great to be able to chat with your listeners as well.
Alrighty, so your event here is coming up here on Thursday night at the Jefferson, 7:30, The Power of Policy Reform to Address Racial Justice in Erie. We kind of gave a little bit of your CV on the air here just before you came on, but I'm really interested in how you made that connection to kind of put the boots on the ground here in Erie to start addressing some of these racial justice issues. What from your lived perspective, how did you get involved in Erie, PA? You know,
well, you know, this has been a great honor, I have to say, because I think Erie is one of those places that has so much potential for this kind of work. And the way I started was basically I was a former Global Summit speaker at the JES pre-COVID. And as a result of that, JES contacted me to see if I would be interested in working with partner groups, partner organizations here in Erie to focus on racial justice policy reform.
We don't have a great record for the plight of African Americans in Erie. I mean, at one point, some survey said life was the worst in Erie for that, which is not only do we not want to be worse, we don't want to be anywhere close to being worst. Is that what you've experienced as you talk to folks here in Erie?
Well, what I've experienced is that I think there's a lot of appetite to change that reputation. And there's a lot of engagement. And I'm really, really happy to report that we've got groups from all over Erie that are really focused on racial justice and who really want to move away from, you know, what maybe that perception is of Erie. I think there's a lot of promise.
So, okay, when you say promise, again, that means we do have some work to go. What was kind of like the shocker as you started, you know, crunching the data? Because, again, you're very data-focused, as you have to be when you work for Brookings. You know, it has to be about the data. I mean, what are you finding here that kind of is really one of those things that, geez, everybody needs to understand this data point?
So we did crunch a lot of data and, you know, happy to report that all of our partner organizations really, you know, took it in and didn't take it personally.
Okay.
But I think the thing that stands out most in Erie is the level of child poverty. And we were looking at 2019 numbers because 2019 numbers are a little more reliable than 2020. But let's just say that we think 2020 and 2021 are probably worse. So child poverty is actually quite high in Erie.
And what are usually the symptoms that
or what, you know, what are the root causes of that, I should say, of child poverty? Because the whole point of the government safety net is that you don't that you should be able to handle, you know, bring up your children with enough to eat. They shouldn't be food insecure and so on. What are we doing wrong there?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think there are many, many factors. One of the things that we looked at is that unemployment, particularly among low-income communities of color, tends to be pretty high in Erie. That can lead to, you know, obviously a tremendous amount of poverty.
Yeah.
The jobs just aren't there for folks. And we also think that there's a role that Erie Community College and other kinds of educational institutions can play in making sure that you have the kind of skilled labor that's able to get good jobs and able to support their families.
You told the newspaper, you told Kevin Flowers that there needs to be a lot of emphasis on housing, built environment, city planning. I think if anyone was honest with you, they would say that there are forgotten parts of this city that need to be re-engaged. Some of the problem that, as I see it from the outside looking in, because I don't live in that in that I'm not an African American, is that the city itself, the metro, has been, you know, not necessarily been invested in, right? And then you have the subset of particular neighborhoods that if the whole hasn't been invested in, neighborhoods are certainly not being invested in. But that has all changed with opportunity zones and certainly with ARP money. Is just a sheer fire hose of federal funds give you any kind of cause for hope that way, or is it still going to all be about self-realization, pulling up by our bootstraps kind of thing?
Well, I love that question, because I think, you know, there's a lot you can do on your own, but the scale of the problem, not just in Erie, but across the U.S., is certainly one that requires a heavy dose of investment. But the key is that investment really has to be focused on equitable outcomes. So you can get a fire hose of federal money, and you could look back 10 years later and not get any change. We don't want to be there, right? So that's why the partner organizations we're working with here in Erie are really focused on racial justice, because there's a moment right now where we could really flip that script and make sure that Erie does not have high child poverty, that there aren't disinvested areas, and that Erie becomes a lot more vibrant and a lot more viable for a whole range of folks who live here.
I think we're desperate to have build up this workforce. I appreciate that you mentioned the community college. Is education a value that from the littlest of guys, the littlest of kids, that we need to do a better job of instilling the importance of education for all of our folks in the city of Erie?
Absolutely. We need to do a great job of instilling the importance of education. But not only that, just opening up the vistas, that's an important part of learning. So it's not just what's happening in the schools. We want to make sure that that's a great experience and people feel comfortable and supported there, kids especially. But we also want to make sure that everybody knows that there is a whole horizon of jobs and opportunities, and that they could be really successful in a range of occupations. That's a message that needs to get out to everyone. And I'm really hoping that as we continue to work on policy reform here, that that's a message everybody will hear, and it will actually be true.
So unlike maybe some of the folks that are coming from out of town to talk about kind of larger global situations, your speech on Thursday night is very about Erie and Erie policy and changing trajectories. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Global Summit does a great job of pulling interesting people from all over the world with diverse perspectives. But, you know, we also want to figure out what can we do here in Erie to really put Erie on the map of racial justice. And so this is an opportunity to talk about the work that we're doing and to talk about how it might be a blueprint for further work as Erie begins to look around and see itself as part of a global exercise in trying to reach equitable outcomes across the world.
Do you feel that everybody is on, you know, do we finally have all the players in the same room kind of speaking the same language? Sometimes we've seen change kind of either coming from the nonprofit sector or coming from the for-profit sector, and governments behind, you know, been falling behind, or again, there's hands up and, well, it is what it is kind of thing. When it comes to communities of color, you have to make sure you're engaging the faith community, a very important role there. So I guess the question is, are we starting to align here in our voices, in our sectors?
So, yeah, I think, you know, that's always a process. And I think we are really well on the road to that process. That part of that alignment has to do with what's your vision for the future. And I think it's pretty clear that everyone in Erie wants to have a pretty vibrant employment market. And in order to do that, there are a lot of things that have to happen. And I think everybody is pretty aligned on that employment picture. And that, I think, is going to be the source of alignment on a lot of other initiatives as well.
I'd love to get your sense on how families are feeling. You were talking to Kevin Flowers about how measuring how citizens feel, their sense of well-being. And again, that is part and parcel of racial justice of, you know, do you know, are you feeling in your zip code 16503, let's say, as good as somebody who feels in 16505, you know?
Right, exactly. So I'm sure that in 16503 and 16501, you know, if you were to ask people now, that feeling of well-being probably wouldn't be widespread. That's what we're trying to change. And I'm really hopeful that in 5 years, when I have this conversation with you again, the folks in 503 and 501 are feeling about as good as the folks in 505.
As far as policy reform, how much can be done at this local level, and how much needs to be helped by our state legislators or the governor's office, let alone the feds?
So what can be done at this level are things that are very local to Erie. So, for instance, when you think about the way in which Erie tries to attract employers, the kinds of development and investment that the city puts into, you know, specific projects and blocks, that's very local. And that is huge in the way people experience, you know, their own sense of well-being and walking around and how they feel about Erie. That's huge. That's not something the federal government can do. What the federal government can do, the state government can do, is they can provide resources. And those resources are often probably greater than what Erie itself can come up with, but directing it in a way that is meaningful and authentic and really changes the lives of communities of color, in particular in Erie, is something that only local officials can do.
This sounds a lot like elements of the discussion of the new localism of the Bruce Katz conversations that are going on.
Right, exactly. And, you know, particularly for racial justice, when you think about racial justice, it's about how people are treated, you know, as they are going through their daily life. That is a pretty local experience. And so it's really important when we're thinking about racial justice to not only think about sort of these sort of larger levels like the federal and state level, but to think about what can we do that really changes, you know, for the better, that daily experience. And that is an exercise in local cooperation across, you know, advocates of all sorts, the government, all kinds of communities. That's what's going to bring about that kind of change.
I've asked this question to many of my guests about if some of these outcomes are going to be dependent upon maybe some folks that make these kinds of decisions. I'm thinking of everything from authorities to employers, again, every sector, right, to CEOs of nonprofits. Is it going to take some generational change to get to the kind of the, not there's that there's any finish line, but to really advance some of these outcomes forward? Do we need to change some mindsets or wait until some of the old-fashioned thinking gets aged out here?
Well, you know, there's always a little bit of that, but I do think that Erie has some very, you know, human-centered folks across the age distribution. So people who are actually quite experienced and quite seasoned, who are very, very interested in making sure that we have an equitable Erie. So I wouldn't, it's not, you know, for me, it's not out with the old and in with the new in order to get change, but it's about how you speak to what it means to be, you know, somebody who cares about others here in Erie. And I think there are lots of people across multiple age groups and multiple communities that really want Erie to thrive and really want Erie to be the place for racial justice.
I would think it would be hard for some of our, you know, our real stalwarts, our, you know, our older African-American community leaders who have been through the ringer for years and years and years with never having enough investment. I mean, how do they keep hope, right, Camille?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, this is the African-American experience in general in the U.S., right?
Yeah.
So how do you keep hope after 400 plus years of not being treated well and not being treated with dignity? It's something that, you know, African-American communities are actually excel at. And it's a source of strength. And I would love to be in a position where here in Erie, you know, our African-American elders can actually feel like all of that has been worth it.
30 seconds. Give an invitation for folks to come see you on Thursday night.
I would love everybody to join me. Let's talk about how we can get policy reform that ends in racial justice here in Erie.
Camille Bucet, she's a Brookings Institute scholar. The power of policy reform to address racial justice in Erie. And she is on the ground in Erie making the conversations happen, studying the data. Thank you, Dr. Bucet. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks, Joel. It's been great to be here.
You've been listening to The Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast from TalkErie.com. Subscribe to our show on your favorite podcatcher and get involved by emailing joel@talkerie.com.